Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Facebook Threat Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 1st, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Alanis versus the United States. The question in this case is twofold. First, this case asks whether the First Amendment requires proof of the defendant's subjective intent to threaten in order to convict someone of threatening another person under 18 U.S.C. Section 875C, or whether it is sufficient to demonstrate that a reasonable person would consider the statement to be threatening. The second question, in this case, is whether, as a matter of statutory interpretation, conviction of another person requires proof of the defendant's subjective intent to threaten. To discuss the case, we have Kent S. Scheidegger, who is the legal director and general counsel at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Scheidegger.
Today, the Supreme Court heard a hotly contested case on the meaning and limits of freedom of speech in the Internet age. Freedom of speech, like all freedoms, is not unlimited. In particular, constitutional rights do not generally include the right to harm anyone else. Threats are one form of harmful speech that has long been understood to be unprotected. In 1966, during the Vietnam War, a man named Robert Watts was protesting the war and the draft, and he says, "I'm not going. If they ever make me carry a rifle, the first man I want to get in my sights is LBJ," that is, President Johnson. The Supreme Court said this statement was not a true threat. It was instead a crude and offensive method of stating political opposition. Taken in context and regarding the expressly conventional nature of the statements and the reaction of the listeners, we do not see how it could be interpreted otherwise. So in the Watts case, the Supreme Court defined a true threat by looking at the statement, its context, and how the people who heard it in context understood it. Conspicuously absent is any reliance on whether Watts subjectively intended his statement to be a threat. Now we fast forward almost 40 years to the 2003 cross-burning case of Virginia versus Black. Virginia had a statute prohibited burning a cross with intent to intimidate. The Supreme Court took up two cases applying this statute. In the first case, a Ku Klux Klan leader burned a cross at a rally. Now, this was a symbol of hatred and racism, but however despicable it was not a true threat within the meaning of the First Amendment. It was not a threat directed at any identifiable victim. In the second case, two young men attempted to burn a cross on the lawn of a neighbor that one of them had a dispute with. That was a threat, and their cases were remanded and ultimately affirmed. Now, by way of disclosure, I filed a brief in this case to support affirming the convictions in the second case. Now, the Black case involved a statute that had a statutory element that the legislature chose to put in there of a specific intent to intimidate. And because of some language in the Supreme Court opinion discussing that statute, some courts, including the Ninth Circuit, have interpreted that language to impose such a requirement as a matter of constitutional law, even though it wasn't in the Watts case back in the Vietnam era. But the federal statute against transmitting threats in interstate commerce has been understood in most of the country and almost all the circuits to require only that a person knows what he is transmitting and that a reasonable person would regard that statement as a threat. The case before the Supreme Court today involves a Pennsylvania man named Anthony Alanis, whose marriage was breaking up bitterly, unfortunately a much too common event. His wife obtained a protective order known as a Protection from Abuse Order, or PFA. Alanis made a number of posts on his Facebook page, and one of them said, "Fold up your PFA and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet? Try to enforce an order that was improperly granted in the first place. Methinks the judge needs an education on true threat jurisprudence. And if worse comes to worse, I've got enough explosives to take care of the state police and the sheriff's department." Well, he made that statement. He made a number of other statements also appearing on their face to be threats against his wife's life. He also made a threat against an FBI agent who came to investigate and a threat to shoot up an elementary school. First, it's important to understand what is not an issue in this case. Some of the arguments made in support of the defendant talk about the context of his statements, they're being made on the internet, his imitation of rap artists and satirists, and other arguments contending that his postings do not amount to true threats. Nobody in this case is challenging the rule established in Watts that a statement is protected expression and not a true threat if, when it is evaluated objectively and with full consideration of its context, it is not an actual threat of violence against a person, but merely hyperbole. Now, the jury in this case was instructed on an objective, reasonable person standard and resolved that argument against Alanis. So the Supreme Court today is not second-guessing that decision. Instead, it's considering the defendant's argument that he was entitled to a different instruction on a different standard. He claimed at trial and in his briefing that he was entitled to an instruction that a statement is protected expression and not a true threat unless the person making the statement intends in his own mind to make a threat, regardless of how that statement appears to other people on its face and in its context. So this case is not just about free speech, but it is also about the mental state required for a speech to constitute a crime. Traditionally, the mental element of crimes was defined as either general intent, meaning simply that the person did it on purpose as opposed to accidentally, or specific intent, committing the act with a specific purpose in mind. These formulations were widely criticized, and beginning in the 1960s, the trend has been to adopt a more precise hierarchy of mental states along the lines proposed in the Model Penal Code. The highest and most culpable mental state is purpose, committing the crime to achieve a specific bad end. The next step down is knowledge, committing the crime knowing that the act is a bad one or knowing that a bad result will follow. This is followed by recklessness, committing a crime knowing that it creates a grave risk of harm, but doing it anyway. And the last step down is negligence, which is usually not bad enough for a criminal offense. Now, at trial, the defendant requested an instruction that would have imposed an element of purpose. Quoting a Ninth Circuit opinion, he asked that the jury be instructed that, quote, a communication objectively indicating a serious expression of an intention to inflict bodily harm cannot constitute a true threat under the statute unless the communication is also conveyed for the purpose of furthering some goal through the use of intimidation. In his briefing in the Supreme Court, Alanis insisted that subjective intent was constitutionally required, which seems to mean the same thing. He also insisted that the reasonable person instruction given at trial was a mere negligence instruction rather than a knowledge instruction. So right out of the gate in today's argument, Justice Ginsburg questioned how the government could ever prove a case with a defendant's proposed standard, noting the difficulty of proving what is in someone else's head. Chief Justice Roberts noted the alarming implications of allowing a person a license to make threats as long as he can come back and claim it was therapeutic or just art. This is exactly the implication that motivated many victims' advocates, including myself, to file amicus briefs to oppose the defendant's position. John Elwood, representing the defendant, promptly backed away from the position implied in his briefing. He denied that he was seeking an instruction requiring a purpose, as that term is used in the Model Penal Code, but instead argued that the government must prove the defendant had knowledge that his statements would place a person in fear. Justice Kagan then asked why a recklessness standard would not be sufficient. If a person can be criminally liable for making statements that he knows will cause fear, then why not for statements that are highly likely to cause fear? Elwood's response was that teenagers mouthing off on the internet might get thrown in jail for sarcastic comments that were not actual threats. Chief Justice Roberts noted that the reasonable person standard takes that context into account. Justice Kagan noted that a different branch of First Amendment jurisprudence, the fighting words doctrine, has no subjective intent requirement. The only requirement is that the defendant said words likely to start a fight and he knew what he was saying. Elwood's response was that fighting words were narrowly defined and that there is no time for law enforcement to intervene. But threats cause harm by themselves, even if no violence actually ensues, so that does not seem to be much of an answer. Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben argued for the government. He seemed genuinely annoyed by the petitioner's change in position. Even so, he pressed on with the government's position that only knowledge required in this case is that petitioner knows what he is saying and what it means. Justice Kagan questioned going that far down, as she characterized it. She asked to have some sort of buffer zone where needed, as is sometimes said in other First Amendment areas. Dreeben's response was that threats of violence have so little First Amendment value that no buffer is needed. Justice Scalia appeared to be receptive to this argument. Addressing concerns about chilling speech and lyrics by rap artists, Rabin noted that a concert performance was a very different context, and the reasonable person standard takes this context into account. Well, predicting outcomes from Supreme Court arguments is always dicey at best. We can, however, be confident that the most alarming possibility from a victim's perspective is not going to happen. People are not going to be allowed to make threats that are clearly threats and that they know are clearly threats and still defend on the basis that in their own minds, unknowable to anyone else, they were just kidding. How much farther down the scale of mental states the Supreme Court will go remains to be seen. The government may have to prove the defendant knew he was going to cause fear, or that he was reckless about causing fear, or that he simply knew he was saying what he said and a reasonable person would take it to be a threat. And that is the answer we will have in a few months.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.